With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's get tonight started.
Like the sun.
Tonight, let's talk a little bit about human population and its impact. By about 2050, the human population is expected to reach 9 billion. Now, those billions will be seeking food, water, and other resources on a planet where humans are already shaping climate and the web of life. Will we overheat or innovate, conserve or despoil, crash, or round the curve with a few scrapes? Environmental journalist Andrew Revkin presents an exploration of ways to share and shape ideas that can foster progress on a finite planet. He focuses in particular on the unique role of universities as hubs of innovation, learning, and most important, doing. And here is our presentation for this evening called Building the Noosphere, Durable Progress on a Finite Planet.
This program is a presentation of University of California Television. Your support makes UCTV's programming possible. Contribute online at uctv.tv/support. Check out our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, at youtube.com/uctvprime. Subscribe today to get new programs every week.
Human impacts, our numbers and our appetites are just explosively growing. This is, if you go to population.org, and those with the smartphones or computers can do this right now, they have this calculator, put in your birth date, and you can, like I did, and I'm getting to be old, you know, it's like more than 50 years, and you can find out where you are on this spiking, well, you can see it's not quite spiking, but this curve of us, and I was around when there were 2.7 billion of us, that's when I was born, and now we're at 7. Heading pretty confidently toward 9 or so by mid-century, before whatever comes after that. And it could be more, it could be less. You can see how just a little tweak in fertility rates can make a big change, not to mention longevity rates going forward. So, but we know there's going to be more of us, and we know that when we get money, we like to spend it. So consumption and population are both still in this kind of remarkable trajectories. This was a picture one of my colleagues at the Times took on that wonderful day, Black Friday, a few years ago. And can you imagine 9 billion people going to Target, you know, and shopping this way for the three shirts for $15 or whatever? It doesn't seem possible to fit that on a finite planet. And we know, you can look, I'm sure you've seen the various calculations for that there's limits to just sheer growth and stuff. So how do we kind of modulate our trajectories? What can we do to use our intelligence to sort of not butt up against the planet's limits? For the moment, this is another one of those downer realities. For the moment, there's not a lot that separates us when you look at these trajectories from bacteria on a plate of agar. And my son just did this for his science fair project a year ago. You know, he took a swab and put it on the dog's paw and then put it on the plate. And you know, basically bacteria just grow until there's not enough stuff to grow on anymore, and then something happens. There's either a crash or the waste products hem you in. So for me, and I wrote about this on Dot Earth a couple of years ago, the question really is, can we sort of intentionally find what you might call peak us before nature imposes on us peak us? And so there's an option here. How much of this is enforced by outside limits, and how much can we modulate? So, and it essentially it comes down to, I like the agar meme, because it's sort of like scientists for the last half century have been saying, hey, there's an edge to the Petri dish. It's over, there's an edge to the Petri dish. It's out there. And we, for the moment, though, we're still kind of stuck in that, oh, well, there's a lot of stuff around us kind of behavior. And it reminds me, the scientists, like here, this was Martin Parry in 2007 at the IPCC climate change report rollout, with this big laundry list of essentially edges to petri dishes, water, energy, ecosystems. And so, but you think about this, think about what you see here, and then think about when you were a teenager. Some of you might even still be teenagers. Are there any teenagers in the room? You don't have to identify. But so when you're a teenager and your parent is, or you know, you come in late or you've driven too fast, you got a ticket, and you know, someone, some adult is going, you know, now son, you're going to be in trouble. Does that message resonate? And so for me, this feels a lot like James Dean's experience in Rebel Without a Cause. So that is global society being chided by scientists and others who are saying there's limits to growth. You know, and this all, and I've written this repeatedly on .earth also, it reminds me of essentially we face the juncture between adolescence and adulthood, which is kind of like the difference between a sprint and a marathon in a racing metaphor. Can we find a way to shift gears, literally, so that we have a long-haul approach to the way we live, from having this right now still pretty much grab what you can get adolescent approach to what we can, how we live. And that's really a fundamental issue. And it's at the level of the individual and at the level of cultural norms and societies. You know, we're still, how do you measure growth? How do you define progress? These are questions that are starting to be asked finally by serious people who through much of the 20th century were locked into an 18th and 19th century idea of growth. And now I think there's promise. I think people are actually recognizing you build a bigger basket of indicators and start to shift how you think. But just to give, I'm not done with the downer part here yet. Our human nature is really a fascinating thing. And this all crystallized in another way at the 2006 at the Supreme Court, when this exchange happened over whether CO2 should be regulated as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act. And James Milkey, representing the state of Massachusetts and the other parties pushing for this, had to correct Justice Scalia, who had misstated something about the atmosphere. And this funny exchange happened that's worth playing out. Respectfully, Your Honor, it's not the stratosphere, it's the troposphere. Justice Scalia says, troposphere, whatever. I told you before, I'm not a scientist. Laughter. That's actually in the official transcript. That's why I don't want to have to deal with global warming, to tell you the truth. And it's really easy, as I've said before, to look at this as just, you know, conservative Supreme Court justice, what a jerk. You know, if you come at it from a certain political standpoint, you might have that reaction. But I think when you dig deep on an issue like climate change, you realize that we all don't want to have to deal with this to some extent. It's not a Republican-Democrat issue. It's not a conservative-liberal issue. It's a fundamental reality. This is that question of, you know, can we constrain ourselves? And it's an interesting challenge and question. One of the things that I've learned in the last few decades in writing about things like climate is I started out mainly thinking about this as a biogeophysical issue. You know, what I'm talking about, greenhouse gases, carbon cycles. And then I got more focused on the climate in here. And I wrote a piece called An Inconvenient Mind, which is about some of the realities that I think we're starting to recognize, partially because, for me, starting to blog 5 years ago, I started to really understand the primal, maybe it's, the word primal is actually okay, the primal nature of some of the differences among us. And there's a really valuable website, culturalcognition.net. It's a guy named Dan Kahane at Yale and other researchers who study empirically. They do experiments, it's behavioral experiments, that demonstrate powerfully that in this room, well, this is kind of a selected group, but in an average room in America, in a country, you have natural divisions in how people react to information. That a liberal and a libertarian, the common terms of art, are what these folks call a communitarian and an individualist. And there's fundamental reactions to information. You can actually test these that show that that's a very powerful stuff. That's very powerful differences. So, and I did a piece of a couple years ago where I looked at some Nobel Prize winners in physics who've weighed in publicly on global warming. And so among people who are really smart, who've achieved greatness in physics, you have a very wide range of reactions to this thing called global warming. So Ivar Gaever from Rensselaer, who's now emeritus, he recoiled when he saw the word incontrovertible in the American Physical Society statement on climate. So for him, that would felt like religion. And so he now publicly, repeatedly lambastes those who speak of the climate crisis or global warming as a serious problem. Steve Chu, of course, has a different approach. Bert Richter is a very active Californian on energy and climate, and he's very concerned, and he has a very specific and different approach to the solution, focused largely on nuclear power. Robert Laughlin is kind of in the mushy middle. He's not quite sure. So there are actually, even among Nobel Prize winners in physics, you have the same delineations that you see in a broader selection of humanity, which says to me, as a journalist, when I started to dig in on this stuff and realized after 25 years of writing about climate and humans, and realizing that, you know, I could spend the rest of my career writing, trying to write the best possible story, or maybe do a documentary, or do some new thing that would finally tell the story in a way that would make people have a common experience and reaction and response on an issue like climate. It was devastating to kind of start to realize, this is just it. This is the way it is. And then you think, well, that's game over, but it's not at all. And when you dig in on this work a little more, you start to see that there actually are real opportunities to move forward. But it requires some letting go. One of the things, of course, that we have to let go of because it's happening right now is that the media are going to save you. that in the old days, here's another weird reality for those of us born in the 20th century who spent, like I think in this room, probably two-thirds of you, well, maybe half of you have spent more of your life in the 21st century than the 20th century. For me, that's kind of a sobering reality. But when I was young, my family, every night, while we were eating our comfort food, you know, mac and cheese or whatever, we were listening to three white men. You chose which white man you wanted. Tell us the way of the world. And Walter Cronkite,
this is my last one,
said this.
The anchor man, CBS Evening News, and that's the way it is. Friday, March 6, 1981. This is my last broadcast.
So that's the way it is. That's, you know, we had that comforting feeling. The news was handed to us. The state of the world was something we didn't have to sort of think about, critically analyze, come to our own conclusions about. It just was doled out to us like comfort food. And now, you know, now there's this horrible reality that we're all still dining on comfort food, but everyone's choosing his own or her own meal. If you want sushi or Indian or Tex-Mex, or climate contrarianism or climate worry or you know, government output, you can kind of choose your own reality. So there too, you can look at that and go, oh my God, throw up your hands. Or you can dive in and try to figure out how to use these systems to have the best chance of having constructive discourse, of having you know, argument with a point in mind, with a goal to move forward. And one of the things I've found that's useful in any debate is to define your terms. And you know, too often I see people yelling about global warming. Global warming is a hoax. It's a catastrophe, without actually defining the terms. So again, I think there's an opportunity, and this is not web. You can do this on paper. You can do it in a book. But to start to deconstruct ideas and issues in ways that can forge at least meaning that can be then lead to more cogent discussion. And one thing is on something like global warming is to break it apart. You know, I'm not going to get in an argument with you about whether you believe in global warming until we have a sense of what we're talking about. And I found that even with arch skeptics, it's a good starting point. So you can say, okay, we can set aside CO2 as a greenhouse gas. Richard Lenz and Michael Crichton, the author of State of Fear, you know, who rejected environmentalism before he died a few years ago, they all agree that greenhouse gases are real. They make the world warmer than it would otherwise be. So we can set that aside. And then, but here's part of the ugly reality on an issue like global warming, is that the aspects of this question that are most consequential for society are still tough. And recognizing that reality, that you can have real, not manufactured, debate about sea level rise, about what's going to happen with hurricanes in a warming world, about regional climate forecasts, and of course, one of the most durable sources of uncertainty is just simply how warm it's going to get from a certain buildup of CO2. Then at least you understand, you know, okay, we can grapple on those issues, but that, and all of this is just the science. Then once you have established the terms on those questions, then you move into the what do you do about it part, and that's a whole another level of disputes, and there you can start to understand, well, here at least we can have a data-driven discussion. And when we move, then we can have a separate, okay, now let's stop that conversation and move to the what do you do about it part, recognizing the uncertainties there in this picture. And when, by the way, just so you get the idea of what I'm doing here, the shallowness of the curve demonstrates the maturity or lack of it, of the idea, the scientific concept. So, this is the distinction between what David Hume, the philosopher, and I learned this from a climate scientist, Ken Caldera, who minored in philosophy in college. David Hume said, you can't get an ought from an is. You're mostly focused on defining the parameters of a problem, but what you do about the problem is up to society more largely. We had a discussion with David Lee about this in my class here last night. It was interesting. And I do think there are opportunities for scientists to still dive in and talk about the full spectrum of the problem, but it takes two sentences. One sentence is, here's my work on ecosystems and a changing climate, period. And here's what I, as a resident of California, and a taxpayer, and a father or a mother, think about whether we should have mandates or taxes or innovation push or whatever. And once you do that, at least then you can discharge the argument about the science. And that's an important thing in going forward. And now just circling back to the social science work, the empirical work, and it's really revelatory that there are ways forward on these issues. The Six Americas study, that's an ongoing project by Yale and George Mason Universities, is invaluable in helping to delineate what I was talking about earlier, that there's a normal nature of division in society on issues like climate. And these bubbles are their population, basically they're the proportion of us that believes about in climate in a certain way. So there's alarmed, concerned, cautious, disengaged, doubtful, and dismissives among us. Probably in this room there aren't a lot of these. But you get the idea. So when you ask people in this large ongoing survey, this was 2009, in the run-up to the cap-and-trade bill debate, they were asked, well, what do you think about cap-and-trade? Of course, you know, a lot of people don't have a real understanding of what that is anyway, but they have a vague idea that it's a regulatory project with trading to limit the costs of emissions reductions. And what was so revealing to me in seeing this is that even those who are most alarmed about global warming were in the mid-range at best on this issue of cap and trade. So anyone who thought this was going to pass through a divided Congress wasn't reading this literature. It's like, how could that, if the alarms aren't even for this, then why are we even debating this? So you could look at that and say, okay, throw up your hands, forget about it. But then you look at energy and you see a whole different range of views. When the question is support for providing rebates on purchases of solar panels and fuel-efficient vehicles, everybody is at least at the midline. And even the dismissives are like, oh, maybe. So that says to me, oh, my God, why are we having this big fight over this thing called the climate crisis when no one has a common definition of it, for one thing, and you have all this agreement on energy. And when I talk to economists, I'm sure there's a few in the room, they'll say, well, that's easy. That's because this question is about giving away money. So everyone's for that. Rebates, you know, rebates, freebates, whatever. But look at this graph. Support for requiring, you know, for all the libertarians, 45 mile per gallon fuel efficiency across vehicle fleets, even at a $1,000 price premium. So this is about mandates and imposed costs. And there, only the dismissives dip below the midline. So again, you know, what was all that fighting about? Why were we so focused? There's some among us who still feel we have to fight the climate fight. It has to be climate first. I get into some interesting arguments on the web with people who have a different view. And that's fine. You know, I understand the world is different. But, the reality is such that I feel that a lot of that's wasted wheel spinning and actually counterproductive in the end because it's a source of unnecessary polarization. So now back to this word, which, the last thing the world needs is a new word. We're surrounded by new words. But the good news is it's not really a new word. It's actually a really old word. It's just sort of a new spelling. It's kind of a simplified spelling of an old word. And the old word is noosphere, which comes from the Greek, essentially planet of the mind. And it was an idea articulated early in the 20th century by a French theologian, Teilhard de Chardin, and a Russian geochemist, Vernadsky, who I first wrote about in 2002 in the Times article on managing planet Earth. So for all your environmental management people, you know, that's essentially what we're talking about here, managing the environment in a big way. And they had this concept that essentially this sheath of human intelligence was becoming a force, you could say a force of nature, a potentiality for sustaining the system in a larger way. And actually, James Lovelock, in his next book, I just spoke to him about this not long ago. He said his next book is on Gaia, this being essentially the mind of what he called Gaia. But this goes back further. It goes back to Darwin, and I wrote about this at a certain point. In The Descent of Man, Darwin had a whole section on tribalism, and one of the impediments to human progress is our nature, that we like to be in groups, like we are right here, the environmental concerned group. But he foresaw a day when we would surmount, sort of overcome our tribalism. He said there was only an artificial barrier to doing that, and right now we're building the technology to get around that barrier through just the ability to have a global conversation about these issues. So it's kind of an interesting lineage for this concept. Now, what is a noosphere? To me, it's all about intentionality. It's not like a new website or WikiNo or something. It is a hashtag. I do think that I'm trying to build a conversation around that word. It's a network of schools, libraries, businesses, individuals, institutions that are eager to collaborate in fostering human progress that fits on a finite planet. And that has many faces. And I'll explain briefly what I mean by it. I really started to build my sense of aha on this when I was in, of all places, Istanbul, in a slum in the middle of Istanbul, writing about earthquake risk, because I write about all kinds of disasters. And such a great life. So I was there trying to see how communities were going to get ahead of the curve. The curve being that the inevitability of great earthquakes in what are now megacities is just written. It's not only written in stone, but it's written in the artwork. This is Istanbul in 1509. If you go through the art history of the city, you see that they have art from all the calamitous earthquakes going. And here it was a woodcut, and then it's a lithograph, and then it's like a painting, and then it's a photograph. But the pattern is there. So what do you do to get ahead of that? So I was there to write about that. And whenever a reporter goes to some interesting place where you look foreign, you're like a kid magnet. And in Istanbul, these kids are all running up to me. This was a school that had been retrofitted with some World Bank money to withstand this inevitable earthquake. And the kids are all running up to me, and instead of saying American, or they're saying Facebook? And that was a real eye-opener. I was just talking to, right, we were just talking about someone else who's in Mongolia and had this similar experience. The world is just becoming so knitted by this ability to interact. It's remarkable. So a bunch of these kids are now my Facebook friends. And just think back a few decades to when I was their age, it was this. This was our Facebook. You know, but pen pal took weeks. Like, I'd send this crinkly envelope letter to Alfred Iwani in West Cameroon, and then I'd get this letter back another couple of weeks later, or a month later. And it was meaningful to me. So at the age of 12, I had the sense of Cameroon that I wouldn't have had because of this. And now there's no reason our kids can't be collaborating, playing with, whether it's Minecraft, as my 14-year-old son plays, or other games, and then learning with, and then, you know, collaborating with globally other kids, other generations, other communities. It's just happening at the pace of the speed of light, literally. And then here's another one of the downers, of course, is that the world is not all linked. There's kids in this slum in Guinea, right out in the capital of Guinea, and I put this picture on my blog periodically because it reminds me that, you know, about 2 billion people still don't have reliable electricity, let alone access to the web. And these kids have to go to the airport parking lot to do their homework because in their slum, in a city, they don't have electricity. And that's, to me, a scandal, but also a huge opportunity. So finding business models or facilitating the ability to get at least enough electricity into communities so they can do their homework at night safely at home, homework would be a good thing. There's another aspect to this picture that it took me, I think it was the third time I posted it on the blog, I realized there's no girls. But that's a whole nother lecture, as you know. Now here's the exciting thing. That's the downer. There's a huge number of people who are on the other side of a digital divide and an energy divide. But the change that's underway is stunning. This is already out of date. This goes from 2000 to 2010. This is cell phone subscriptions from ITU, ITU.int. It's the International Telecommunications Union or something. Anyway, so basically just over a decade ago, there were 700 million cell phones on the planet. Two-thirds of them were in rich countries. Now there's 6 billion, this is 5.3, 6 billion, billion, billion with a B, cell phone subscriptions, and three-quarters of them are in poor countries. Now obviously a big chunk of that is China, and another chunk is India. But the change that you see on the ground when you have that little bit of connectivity is just stunning. And again, I'm sure many of you have been in developing countries where you've seen this. It's the bank. It's your way to get to know where to sell your corn. For women, it's a conduit to radio talk shows about women's issues that they wouldn't otherwise be engaged in. It's an amazing thing. So a couple of years ago, a colleague at the Times went to Kenya, to a rural place. So remember, the kids are doing their homework by street parking lot light in Guinea. So here is a woman who got tired of having to go into town once a week or go to charge her cell phone. And so she saved up money, invested in a cheapo solar panel, put it on the roof, and started finding out the wonders of a dribble of watt minutes. This is not kilowatt hours, you know, watt minutes can be transformative. Her kids are doing their homework by LED light in this rural village in Kenya. She started selling her excess electricity to her neighbors, so she was charging their cell phones. And in the course of reporting the story, Libby Rosenthal found the neighbors were already buying they're buying solar panels to put on their roofs. And so when I, you know, if someone gave me a pot of money and said, you could install a $40,000 photovoltaic panel on a roof in Santa Barbara, or you can take that same money and do $60, you know, however many hundreds of these $60 ones and put them in rural Africa, I'd do that in a heartbeat. And so we have to think about those issues when we think about where to focus our attention. It's worth doing. Now here's another example of what's going on around the world. So the World Cup came to South Africa. And you think, well, what does that have to do with anything? It has a lot to do with everything. What happened was some smart businessmen and women got ahead of this. They realized South Africa didn't have enough bandwidth to broadcast to the world in HD, you know, all these games. So there was an investment in laying a subsea cable. There's a company called Seacom, S-E-A-C-O-M. Look them up online. That invested in running a cable from South Africa to Europe along the East Coast, and it was like a bandwidth explosion for Eastern Africa. And so now that the World Cup is over, all countries along Tanzania, Kenya are all tying into that cable, and it's greatly reducing the cost of internet access in those countries. It was privately financed. It was three-quarters African capital. It was not a World Bank philanthropic thing or a Bill Gatesy thing. It was just what's happening. And it's happening at a pace that we can't readily grasp. This is, and I wasn't even aware, there's a scholar at Harvard, Calestous Juma, J-U-M-A, who's from Kenya originally, who led me to this work. And it's so interesting to see. And you can actually see the cabling. And I still think about satellites mostly, but this is happening in a way that's really powerful and happening, again, at light speed. It's very encouraging, exciting. And it's one reason I wake up in the morning excited, not even though there's all the reasons to be enervated and cynical. And for me, the big chunk of this thing called Noosphere is Match.com. It's like the world's ultimate Match.com. And it's not for, you know, girls and boys who want to get together. It's for ideas that are lacking components. And there's a long history of people who study innovation history, like Andy Hargadon at UC Davis, have demonstrated everything from the steam engine onward. There's usually a logjam, something that could have happened much faster, sometimes years faster, if the right expertise had been applied at the right moment and that wasn't. And now we have no excuse for that taking time. because of this, the capacity to share and shape ideas. And there's lots of really interesting innovations underway. New York Academy of Scientists started Scientists Without Borders. It's NYAS.org. This is the New York Academy of Sciences. There's Innocentive, which is a money-making model for, you know, a company that has an idea or a problem it needs to solve and wants to harvest the crowd to solve it. There's Kickstarter and Global Giving, which are basically resource sharing portals. But there's so much more that can be done. And it can be done. I see universities as playing a particularly valuable role here. I was at a meeting of the AAAS a couple of years ago, and there was a session on what science teachers need. It was basically, you know, the struggling science teacher with no budget and no time and all these obligations. What do they need? One of the things they need is little explanatory videos, little introductory videos on momentum or on what's a greenhouse gas or whatever. And I'm surrounded now that I teach by young communicators, including my 22-year-old son who's at Pace, who loves to do sort of animations and stuff. And they're just sitting there waiting to have meaning, not just to do their work and learn their skills, but to do stuff. So a couple of years ago, some students in Northern California put together a video on geoengineering. Oh, wait.
Today on Ways of the Future, a closer look at geoengineering.
It's pretty funny.
What is geoengineering? Well, geoengineering is something global, intentional, and unnatural. And we've got some smart fellers figuring out new methods. Let's look at a few. Space mirrors. In this lifelike reenactment, Eric is the sun, and Patrick is the earth. As Patrick orbits Eric, he receives some of Eric's solar radiation, making Patrick very warm. Let's see what Patrick has up his sleeve. By deploying space mirrors, Patrick deflects some of Eric's warming radiation, making himself comfortably cool.
Now it goes on. It's really fun. Now here's another example. Again, I write about earthquakes. So I got to know the work of Santiago Pujol, who's an engineer, earthquake engineer at Purdue. And after the Sichuan disaster in China, I was focused on how to make schools safer because there's, you know, we're in the world's biggest building boom right now. So if you can get ahead of that and get smarter designs in the places where you're having this building explosion happen, especially schools. Think of the averted losses, both in lives and everything else that comes in a school. And so he had this. He looked at these buildings at Pancake, and he came up with a better design that doesn't take any different materials. It's the same set of bricks and columns and rebar. If you just configure it in a different way, it's safer. So I wrote about it in the Times, which is great, but the Times is a very small readership globally, and I want to find ways to get that information where it really matters, which is to the unlicensed builder in some town in Iran or in Afghanistan or in India. And there are ways to do this, and I'm not saying I solved the problem, but here's an example. So this is the pancaking issue. This is Mexico City. This is Taiwan. You can see there's basic structural problems in buildings that have. And I'm going to show you what Daniel, my sophomore son at Pace, did this video to demonstrate the issue. To be in the movies, doing special effects. So that's the problem. And he has to tweak it. There's more to be done. So here's the same building. Now just move the materials around, and you have a fundamentally sturdier structure. You do that, and then here we go to actual video of a shake table, the three-story build-out of the building. And it shows you that basically when you put all the bricks in one side, they stabilize the columns instead of shearing the columns. And this shows you what the design can look like. And Pujols did this. So you take the engineering skill, you take the animation skill, you take the communication interest, and you put those together, and you have more than any of the individual components themselves. So what you need, again, is like a match.com. Hey, I got this cool design. I need someone to do X. And you can think about if you're doing a master's project and you have to present your data in a month and you want to have an animation of some batch of data, I'm not sure, I don't know Flash, but some of you probably know Flash and know how to do statistics and know how to do the science. But I bet together you could find those components much more efficiently by through the community. And we can learn in a networked way that's never been possible before. This is, there's a group called Atlantic Rising. geoengineering.org, which did a, they went around the Atlantic, young people from Britain, educators, and they did this, classroom sessions and coastal workshops on sea level rise for kids. And they, this is what they look like. I was with them by chance in Massachusetts, and they were showing essentially what 3 feet of sea level rise means for your community. And then, just to go back to that other slide, you see they then connected a lot of these classrooms where they did these projects have stayed in touch through Skype. So you have students in Ghana and Scotland co-learning about the changing sea level and what that means for coastal communities. I think, again, think about how many applications of that are possible. And not just among students at the same age level. You could have students, grad students, teaching or doing presentations that relate to elementary school kids. And I think the networked learning possibility is really great. Hold on, let me just go forward. Oh, and then Twitter. I got to get to Twitter. So a lot of Twitter is like this, you know, blah, 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 Bieber, 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 whatever. But within that, and I think a bunch of my students here this week have learned that you can actually organize that. You can modulate the noise just by how you use Twitter as a search tool. It's essentially, for me, it's like a two-way sensory apparatus. It allows me to track issues that I really care about and I want to stay kind of connected on. And I build my own community through these people I follow of kind of people who are out there sensing and tracking and disputing and debating the ideas that are important to me on energy, population, economics, and stuff. And there are agencies, government agencies like NASA, that have figured this out. One of the most interesting and useful demonstrations of this is Asteroid Watch. So if you go to at Asteroid Watch on Twitter, that's NASA's, the JPL feed on keeping track of the big rocks that are going to hit the Earth from someday. And just go there and figure it out. And then Bren Climate, I just started that. See, you can just do this spontaneously. I said, there shall be a hashtag for my 1 week course at Bren, Bren Climate. So put that symbol into Twitter and you'll see our class. You're going to see our learning process, which is really cool. Do-it-yourself stuff has never been easier. And it's really more of do it together. It's like DIT instead of DIY. In the sense, this is a fracking database that someone in Pennsylvania assembled. It's called fracktrack.org. That is essentially, all this stuff is out there. He just took the government permits, violations, and drilling, you know, where wells have already been drilled, and put that into a database. So if you live in Bradford County, which is here, you can literally see what's going on in your neighborhood. And he said, I interviewed the guy, it took him like 4 hours to do this. It's just a matter of getting the database. He knows how to do this GIS stuff that I have no clue about. Very cool. I'm going to speed forward. I'm going to skip NYU, which is explainer.net is worth jotting down. Just go to that website and check it out if you care about fracking. So one thing we forget in all of our concern about those poor developing countries is that this noosphere is a two-way, it's actually a multi-directional pipeline. So when Seoul, South Korea, when the mayor in 2005 or so decided to redo the city center and rip out all the pavement there and restore a stream that had been there for ever since there's been Seoul. It's a marvelous demonstration in softening a cityscape and making it more climate friendly, making it more resilient for flooding, and making it more walkable and more pleasant generally. I did a page one story for the Times on this in 2009. And now the same potentiality, one of my images went away. This is Yonkers, New York. And in the 1920s, there's a picture that was supposed to be there, of when they took the Sawmill River and put it underground. It's in a giant pipe. And now they're planning to rip it out. So this is the Sawmill River in Yonkers, New York, right here. Nice. So, but they're finally going to, partially inspired by South Korea, they're going to dig it out and daylight the stream and make Yonkers more of a softer living city, which I think shows you the potential. Now, Randy Olson is going to be here later today to speak with my students, and he coined this term, the nerd loop. And I think it's important. I mean, we're kind of in the nerd loop right now. We're all talking to each other about how to communicate rather than doing it, unless you've been tweeting, and then you're out of the nerd loop. But it is important to get out, to test drive ideas, to be a little gutsy. Richard Alley at Penn State is ridiculously gutsy. He's a prize-winning scientist. He also has tenure, so it's easier for him to be goofy. But here he is. He does this kind of these wacky music videos where it's like Woody Allen meets Johnny Cash, if you can imagine. And this was an experiment I did on Dot Earth that's now become a regular feature, where a scientist in the field sends me stuff, and we put together kind of a report on something interesting without me actually being there, which was the old model of journalism, a guy with a pad going with you. And showing and telling, remember the power of images, experimenting, finding someone to collaborate with who can turn data into images. Think about this example. I could tell you in an introductory geography class for junior high school students, I can say the volume of the atmosphere is however million cubic kilometers, or I can do what Adam Neiman did, which was that introductory slide, and show you that's the volume of the atmosphere if you put all the air at sea level pressure. That's it. So as we head toward 9 billion people, that's what we have to figure out how to share. It's a great starting point for discussions on issues of commons. And here's all the words liquid water. If you peeled off the oceans and the lakes and the rivers, that's it. That's the volume. And it's not something to argue about. It's actually the volume. So it's a way. And then, of course, if you're pedagogically, think about this. If I'm facing a room full of freshmen or freshman women, and I wanted to say, okay, so that's the world's water. Now your homework assignment is to draw the world's drinkable water. How big would that be? And you can't even see it. At that scale, you wouldn't see it. So that's a powerful learning experience that is about learning by doing. Making the invisible visible. This is a sunny day in Colorado. And this is the same sunny day in Colorado through infrared imagery. You see that's what the leaking methane from a gas facility looks like. So if we can just see, use imagery to tell stories in different ways, and sometimes it's just changing the wavelength, and you have a much richer story to tell about the opportunity for capturing this gas, burning it efficiently instead of letting it get into the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. And then there's how we teach. This is my wife used to teach science at a middle school, and that was her and her co-teacher doing a very familiar exercise, which was kids, you know, using balsa wood to build bridges and breaking them. Learning by breaking, you know, getting familiar with failure. And also what they did was really cool. They added an element to this where the students had a cost-benefit exercise. It was performance and cost that were assessed. Not just, they had to buy with virtual money the wood. And think about the richness of that learning experience compared to the kind of testing we're doing now. It's really cool. Now here's something I think is really important. Everything I've been telling you is sort of virtual. This is my son when he was 9 years old, my younger son, getting real. We were in a suburban part of Florida, and he had the camera, and he's making a little mini movie about the wildlife we were seeing.
Looks like a statue.
Now there's a fun moment here that I'm going to conclude with.
I was trying to color hair.
We had been up this little estuary one other time and heard some baby birds in this bushes. So he's looking and looking and looking.
Oh, yes, they're there.
Remember that sound.
There's someone. Move over, I can't see it.
Dad, get out of the way. So now, I treasure getting kids out into the real world, but what's interesting about this is this is a virtual archive of a real experience, and Jack got to post that on my YouTube channel. It's gotten 7,000 views, which is tiny by, you know, Justin Bieber standards, Charlie Sheen standards. So again, you know, there's a lot of noise, but having him have the experience, and then using this virtual technology to share it and build a, you know, sense of community and to be able to tell the story of his perceptions of the real world, I think is a vital thing to build into also how we learn and how we go forward. So that's the deal. We are, and then of course, as Carl Sagan used to emphasize in a way that inspired me to become what I am now, you know, to remember that it is finite, this little pixel, and here's how to reach me. So thank you.
Do you think the lack of public access to scientific research in journals is limiting and contributing to that nerd loop?
Yeah, I was talking earlier about this issue of the journals. I think we're moving to, you're going to see more erosion of the tradition of journals being behind paywalls. And it's partially the function of the pressure from the folks paying for the science, like the NSF, meaning us, taxpayers, need to really push harder to make sure the information that results from these investments is public. There are some scientists and other scholars who are trying to push on the toughest journals. Elsevier now is being is under pressure from a mathematician whose name I forget, who started a boycott Elsevier. He won't publish his papers there, even though they have the world's best math journals. And I think the community has some power to change that. And I'm trying to build sort of a sustainability curriculum that will be a set of modules that are only drawing on open source information. So I think if we as a community start to build and push and find ways to go forward that way, there's progress and promise. But of course then the question is, what's the business model? How do you pay for all this stuff? So there's questions to work out.
I have a question, if I may. Yeah. So how do you deal with the balance issue? You're reporting on a paper in Science, and some journalists go find somebody with the opposite view at some pressure group, and they say that's balance. How do you deal with that?
It's so challenging. I talked about this with my students here earlier this week, because if you the scientist want to be in the public sphere and get interviewed, and you try to stay reality-based and nuanced and reflect the uncertainties or complexity of some particular question, the journalists will come to you and hear all that and then go to someone else. So you have this unfortunate reality that, and the journalistic norms are still very old to build the story around, well, on the one hand, on the other hand. For every PhD, there's an equal and opposite PhD. And of course, think about sea level. I can do that right now at sea level. I can find you Stefan Rahmstorf and John Gregory and have a real debate about sea level. And so if I just do that, and this is about training, then the readers are coming away with confusion and no sense of what we actually understand about rising seas and a warming world. And unfortunately, it takes training. And unfortunately, as I said, the media norms are, remember, we're losing specialized media. And this is where, again, the opportunity arises for the community of scientists and scholars to come in and fill that gap. RealClimate.org, I think, is a good example of a blog that it has problems. I'm not perfectly happy with it, but it's created a space where when a new paper comes out, that's the place, it's like a touchstone, and a place for those who are interested in finding reality can go there and get a sense of reality, both through what's posted and then through the commentary. So in a post-media world, which is what we're entering, it's a great opportunity for institutions and this can include NSF, it can include UCSB, PACE can kind of be part of that discourse from the get-go. So that's the way forward.
A couple of Christmases ago, you expressed real frustration with the partisan divide when it came to climate change. Have your feelings evolved any since then?
In the sense that I've become more cognizant of the normal nature of it. Yeah, in the sense that I would like folks who are engaged in that kind of fight to sort of reflect on the ones who are professional partisans have a field day right now, unfortunately. Because if you're Mark Morano at climatedepot.com can constantly put out the stuff that says we don't know anything about global warming. It's and then amplify it, and that gets picked up by talk radio, and it is divisive and toxic. And the same thing can happen at the other end of the spectrum. So what I've tried to do is to build something with .earth that's kind of saying, there is yelling is implicit, it's out there. There are always going to be people trying to exploit those natural divisions among us. And the political process, Congress is so dysfunctional. The 60-vote supermajority in the Senate alone, I'm not going to solve it all by having .earth out there, but at least you work at sort of building a reality base.
well, I guess we are the masters of our own destiny as far as the future on this planet. We've already impacted life on this planet as it is, as environmental journalist Andrew Revkin has pointed out, and his ideas are creating a noosphere using universities as a hub for innovation, learning, and implementing these things that they're coming up with. He had some fantastic ideas. If you'd like to see this in video form, you can go to www.uctv.tv. This was published on August 23rd, 2012 by UC Television, and they have some fantastic presentations on that site, so check them out. It'll get your brain going and you'll be Googling like crazy. Well, this brings us to the close of another edition of Savage Science Radio. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics, Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for that really cool intro we use every week, and Todd Sheets, our executive producer and owner of Jackalope 105 FM. And until next week, keep your patter and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.